Last week, despite the distractions of the presidential campaign and fights over contraception, the House of Representatives passed what's known as the Jobs Act, which its supporters say will help boost small companies. Joining me now for a look at how the bill aims to do that and why it's being criticized for watering down consumer protections is ProPublica's Jesse Eisinger. His column about the jobs bill was co-published with the New York Times Deal Book, and I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show for today's Backstory segment. Hello, Jesse.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
The official title of the bill is the Jumpstart Our Business Startups Act. Rather clumsy. Will the measure target small businesses, or is it targeting just any startup, even very large ones?
Even some very large companies will be exempted from basic regulations under this act. And that's one of the criticisms, is that it's sort of inadvertently sweeping a bunch of companies and entities into this rubric here. And it would exempt very big companies from having to report, even if they had many thousands of investors.
So the idea is that if we exempt companies, theoretically small companies, from regulations, we're going to encourage them to create new jobs?
Yeah, the idea is that these companies will be able to, because they're unfettered by all these expensive disclosure requirements and regulations, they'll be able to raise more money on public stock markets or from investors, a new range of investors, and this will allow them to flourish and reach more customers. And the capital will be available to small businesses. And there are a lot of problems with these arguments.
Well, will this just return us to the situation before Dodd-Frank?
You know, I don't think it's going to return us to a extraordinarily fragile financial system. But I think that this harkens really back to an earlier crisis, the crisis of the late 1990s, where with the tech stock bubble, and even in the mid 1990s, when we had penny stock flourishing. There were boiler room operations, a lot of them in Long Island or Boca Raton, Florida, that pumped up a bunch of companies that most people haven't heard of anymore. They were sort of flashes in the pan, but they really were effective ways of separating widows and orphans from their money.
Well, why do critics worry that it'll benefit short sellers?
Well, that was sort of my argument, is that the real jobs here are going to be for the boiler room operations, the shills, the frauds, and the short sellers who actually ferret these things out. That's the only jobs that are going to be created from this thing. Short sellers are sophisticated hedge funds who look and try to find overvalued companies. A lot of those are frauds. And if you have a bunch of companies going public that are exempt from basic financial reporting regulations, that's going to be a ripe area for these guys to fish in. And the less sophisticated people, the retail investors, are going to be separated from their money.
The AARP is opposing the bill because they say it's aimed at the elderly. And they're pretty powerful. Are they being heard in Congress?
You know, a lot of the critics didn't mobilize very quickly because they were looking and fighting the Dodd-Frank rules. And Chuck Schumer and the venture capital lobby pushed this through, almost in the dead of night, effectively. And a lot of the consumer groups sort of took their eye off the ball and didn't see this coming. But now they started to mobilize. I think it's a little too late. But you not only have the AARP, you have Arthur Levitt, the former chairman of the SEC, and a bunch of other people, the Certified Financial Analyst Institute, opposing this. A lot of people think this is a troubled bill.
Now, why is Chuck Schumer supporting it? Is it because he sees himself as the senator for Wall Street?
I think that's exactly it. He's always been wobbly on financial reform, and he's been pushing a kind of rollback of Sarbanes-Oxley, which is a decade old now and was the accounting reform law that came into being after Enron and WorldCom. And Schumer has sought to roll back that, and he sort of went along with Dodd-Frank because that's where the tide was going. But since then, he's been lukewarm on it, and he's while strong in other areas of financial reform like consumer protection, he's been very weak on Wall Street reform.
And this is now going to go to the Senate. Mary Shapiro, the chair of the Securities and Exchange Commission, sent a letter to the leaders of the Senate Banking Committee yesterday that highlighted the importance of investor confidence in market protections and expressed her concerns that this bill will undermine that.
It's pretty astonishing that they would seek to roll back financial regulations after a decade of pretty successful law, Sarbanes-Oxley, and after the 2008 financial crisis. It just shows that there are certain things that Congress, certain arguments that Congress is really beholden to about financial deregulation that the public will be harmed by.
Well, we heard not long ago that deregulation led to the problem we are in right now, and now we're talking about furthering deregulation?
I mean, it's pretty ironic, but either the memories are really short or Congress is listening to people who fund the campaigns rather than individual investors.
In her letter, Mary Shapiro wrote, and I'm paraphrasing, that the bill would allow investment banks that underwrite stock offerings to publish research reports before the public offerings, providing investors with information that would compete with the regulated disclosures required by the SEC. Would that mean that investment banks would be able to heat up the market for these IPOs before they're even made?
That's exactly it.
And that's before the SEC makes its own assessment.
Well, they would have to put out their SEC filings, but those are hundreds of pages long, and people would probably read the investor analyst reports before they would read the SEC filings. You know, Elliot Spitzer tried to clean up Wall Street Research to, not great success, but a little bit. And now this would sort of loosen one of the key restrictions, which is that analysts can't write for their own bank's IPOs before they're public. And while I think that more research is probably a good thing, this is just ripe for analysts who work for the investment banks to shill for their offerings before they really get a true assessment. It's not a good reform.
The bill would also allow new public companies to delay compliance with parts of the Dodd-Frank law on executive compensation and shareholder input on pay. So is this a Jobs Act, or is this an instance of deceptive packaging, something called a Jobs Act that's really all about deregulation?
I mean, this is the Congress brought us the Patriot Act, right? So this is a deregulation bill trying to be wrapped in jobs. And as I said, it's a jobs bill for frauds, boiler room operations, Wall Street analysts. It's not jobs for the rest of us.
Well, how much in this bill is about really creating new jobs? Under the Jobs Act, companies would be able to raise money from smaller investors on the Internet, and they'd be able to solicit investors. Does that mean that we could start receiving robocalls urging us to invest in some new company?
What could possibly go wrong by having small companies that aren't vetted and don't have to put out full financials from trying to raise small amounts of money over the Internet? You can't without any securities regulations. You can't imagine why that would pose a problem for people. As I say, this sort of levels the playing field between the United States and Nigeria all the... I think that the idea that this is going to produce jobs is it's a triple bank shot. Maybe some companies would produce jobs if they could raise money this way. But this isn't really about jobs. It's about lowering financial regulation.
But we always package it in terms of helping small companies create jobs, because that's where the jobs are created.
That's where the economic myth of bad job creation comes from, yes. And there are a few sacred cows in American politics, and small business is one of them. And if you're doing something under the guise of helping small business, you're exempt from any criticism.
Now, is the Senate bill likely to be the same?
What I'm hearing from the people that I've talked to is, yes, that the criticism and groups that were mobilizing against this mobilized slowly, but they thought that the Senate was going to be a kind of breaking point, or, you know, a break point for this, that they were going to be able to persuade cooler heads to put reforms in, and that that's not happening, and that the Senate is rushing this out kind of quickly.
Is it surprising that in an election year, both sides of the aisle, which haven't been able to work together pretty much on anything lately, are cooperating on this? Is it because any bill that claims to boost the economy is better than not having a bill in an election year?
That's a little bit of a puzzle to me, exactly what the politics of this are. I don't think that this has been something that the public has been clamoring for. I think that this has really been pushed by venture capitalists, and I think they fund both sides of the aisle. And since they didn't blow up in 2008 and weren't a cause of the financial crisis, they have some credibility left, political capital in Wall Street, in Washington. So I think that is it, that they thought that they could get this bill through under the guise of darkness.
And hasn't President Obama endorsed the bill?
Yeah.
So everybody could take credit for this.
Right. I mean, this is a massively bipartisan measure, Democrats and Republicans working together unusually to lower financial regulations, only a few years after the financial crisis. It seems pretty shameful to me.
My guest is Jesse Eisinger, who has written about the jobs bill, co-published with the New York Times Deal book. I want to move on to something else, Jesse, because earlier this month you wrote a story about how in 2010 the Federal Reserve was trying to decide if it should allow some of the country's biggest financial firms to pay out dividends to their shareholders. Why was the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation urging them not to?
Well, we've heard this week that the Fed conducted a stress test of the nation's biggest banks, and most of them passed, and they could pay a lot of dividends. It was a fairly strict test, but they actually did a stress test that ended last year, a year ago, that people really didn't pay much attention to. And that was the time where they really allowed the banks first to raise their dividend and return capital to shareholders. And that was what I had examined. And at the very beginning of that test, the FDIC under Sheila Bair, which is one of the major bank regulators, protested, and they said the banks are not ready to do this. They shouldn't be allowed out. They're too fragile. We can foresee crises like, say, Europe. And of course, Europe did become a crisis, but the Fed ignored them and let the money out the door.
Well, last year, last March, they allowed 19 banks to do that. How big was the payout to shareholders last year?
You know what? I just got the updated numbers in my story. I had $33 billion in the first 9 months of the year, but they paid out another roughly $10 billion.
$43 billion.
So roughly $42 billion, yep, out the door to shareholders, which means that that money isn't there to cushion a fall, to absorb losses if there is another crisis.
So that reduces the amount of capital in the bank's balance sheet. Doesn't that make them more vulnerable?
Yes, it definitely makes them more vulnerable, and the debate is whether that makes them actually vulnerable or whether they have enough capital. And the Fed said that they had enough capital, but there are a lot of people who think that that's not the case, and that the banking system should be much more adequately capitalized.
What was the thinking that if we allowed the banks to pay out the dividends, it would help shore up investor confidence in the health of these banks?
That's definitely one of the reasons why the Fed did this, is sort of a PR move, trying to build confidence and creating the appearance of confidence or a Potemkin confidence that might eventually morph into a real confidence. And shareholders, unfortunately, it didn't work on shareholders. And bank stocks collapsed last year, and most of the big banks are trading below book value, which means below the net worth that they claim on their balance sheets, which means that investors are deeply skeptical about the health of the banks.
How has the Fed defended its 2011 decision on dividends?
Well, the Fed said we conducted a very serious stress test, and we distinguished between the really strong banks and the weaker banks. And if we made any errors, fortunately, we come back again. And so they came back again and conducted, to their credit, a much stricter stress test this year in 2012, and failed 4 of the 19 banks. And so those 4 couldn't return dividends and raise dividends and buy back stock. But there still remains a lot of questions about even the ostensibly healthy banks and whether they're healthy enough to do this. And a lot of people disagree with the Fed.
Is the Fed subject to lobbying efforts?
Yes, the Fed is subject to intense lobbying efforts. And in fact, so few consumer groups and people naturally who would be skeptical about this kind of return to shareholders don't focus on this at all. So the banks have a sort of clear runway for lobbying. And in my story, it shows that Jamie Dimon and Vikram Pandit, the CEOs of J.P. Morgan and Citigroup, respectively, personally lobbied the man in charge of the stress tests at the Federal Reserve, a guy named Dan Tarullo. And while he says he wasn't affected by that, you know, they have his ear.
You write a lot about the secrecy of the Fed, and its inner battles don't usually become public. Do you think that the people who spoke to you were willing to do so because there was so much disagreement within the Fed?
The Fed is a deeply divided organization. It's extraordinarily dysfunctional. You have reserve banks, 12 of them around the country, and they oversee their biggest banks. And there's enormous amount of suspicion between each of them because they think that the other ones are beholden to the big banks. So San Francisco is beholden to Wells Fargo, and Richmond is beholden to Bank of America. And both of those think that New York is beholden to Citigroup and J.P. Morgan. So there's a lot of mutual suspicion and turf battles and fiefdoms, and they're all suspicious of Washington. So it's a complicated, dysfunctional organization with a lot of backbiting.
Well, before the financial meltdown, I just thought of the Fed as primarily controlling monetary policy. Has the Fed struggled to reassert its role as a regulator during the last 3.5 years?
Yes. I mean, regulation has always been a function of the Fed, but a backwater, especially under Alan Greenspan, who had almost open disdain of regulation, financial regulation, and the Fed's regulatory role. But it's always been a bank overseer. And since then, the Fed has tried to centralize it and tried to be much more serious about bank regulation, and they got a lot more power under Dodd-Frank, the regulatory reform law, to actually, you know, which centralized power at the Fed. And so they've tried to overhaul it, and I think they've made some progress, but it remains a dysfunctional organization and an organization that is in some ways captured by the banks.
As you said earlier, 15 of the 19 banks passed the stress test. But if the results had shown that those banks weren't as strong, could the Fed have prevented them from paying out further dividends?
Yes, the Fed could have. The Fed has that power.
Would that have been likely? Because it might have sent out a very negative message to the rest of Wall Street.
Well, in failing those 4 banks, they did hurt the stocks of that, which they don't like to do. But that's the reality of it. And if the banks that failed are not healthy enough to pay dividends, then their stocks should probably go down. And that's not really the Fed's job to protect investors, so they shouldn't really worry about that much.
I'm talking to Jesse Eisinger of ProPublica, and we have links to both of his stories on our show page at WNYC.org. On another front, yesterday, Jesse, everyone was talking about the New York Times op-ed by Greg Smith, who just left Goldman Sachs, where he had been an executive director and head of the firm's United States Equity Derivatives Bureau business in Europe. Why do you think the reaction to the piece was so big, and why do you think so many people have been attacking what he said?
Well, whistleblowers always get attacked, and they get attacked for a variety of ways. My favorite is that he didn't make a lot of money at Goldman Sachs, so how credible can he be? You know, I think that it was a pretty courageous thing. Now, you know, some of the op-ed had an off-putting tone. You know, they say it, call it a humble brag. I, you know, one of my proudest moments was becoming a world champion ping pong player. That had a slightly off-putting aspect to it. But I think the fundamental message that Goldman Sachs' business is still compromised is one completely true, and it was took courage to say it.
Well, the lead letter in response in the New York Times today was from a man who said, I worked at Goldman Sachs for 35 years or so, and I never saw anything like that. In fact, it was it had some of the greatest integrity of any business in the world. So is that just people coming to the defense of their firm because they want to protect themselves and their own investment? Or do you think that there could be a whole, because Goldman Sachs is so big, that there could be a lot of different worlds within that company?
The business really transformed over the last 12, 13 years. And it went from being a private partnership to being a publicly traded company. And that is a huge change in the corporate culture, because suddenly the partner's money isn't on the line. It's OPM. It's other people's money on the line. And when you're dealing with other people's money, you know, the tendency to be cavalier is much greater. And so that's one huge cultural change. And the other is that the traders have taken over the firm from the investment bankers. And investment bankers depend on relationships. And so they really need to treat the clients well. But traders deal in a binary world, a world where if they lose, the other guy has won. And if they win, the other guy has lost. It's a zero-sum game. And so they see the world that way. And that's a very damaging thing for the culture.
Jesse Eisinger of ProPublica, we've been talking about two of his articles, which are available through our website at WNYC.org. Thank you so much for talking with us again, Jesse. It's always a pleasure.
Thanks. I love being here, so thanks for having me again.